This is the Real World DevOps Podcast, and I'm your host, Mike Julian. I'm setting out to meet the most interesting people doing awesome work in the world of DevOps, from the creators of your favorite tools to the organizers of amazing conferences. From the authors of great books to fantastic public speakers, I want to introduce you to the most interesting people I can find. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of these are available as open source and as a hosted SaaS solution. You can check all of it out at InfluxData.com. My thanks to Influx Data for helping make this podcast possible. Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian. My guest this week is a conversation I've been wanting to have for quite some time. I'm chatting with Christine Yen, CEO and co-founder of Honeycomb and previously an engineer at Parse. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I want to start this conversation off in kind of what might sound like a really foundational question. What are we talking about when we're all talking about observability? What do we mean?
When I think about observability and I talk about observability, I like to frame it in my head as the ability to ask questions of our systems. And the reason we've grabbed that word rather than just saying, okay, well, monitoring is asking questions about our system, is that we really feel like observability is about being a little bit more flexible and ad hoc about asking those questions. Monitoring sort of brings to mind defining very kind of strict parameters within which to watch your systems or thresholds or putting your systems in a jail cell and monitoring bad behavior. Whereas we're like, okay, our systems are going to do things, but they're not necessarily bad. But let's be able to understand what's happening and why. And let's observe and look at the data that your systems are putting out, as well as thinking about how asking more freeform questions might impact how you even think about your systems and how you even think about what to do with that data.
When you say asking questions, what do you mean?
When I say asking questions of my system, I mean being able to proactively investigate and dig deeper into data, rather than sort of passively sitting back and looking at the answers I've curated in the past. In order to kind of illustrate this, to compare observability and monitoring a little more directly, with monitoring, especially traditional monitoring, where we're curating these dashboards, what we're essentially doing is we are looking at sets of answers from questions that we posed when we pulled those dashboards together. Right, so if this dashboard has existed for 6 months, the graphs that I'm looking at to answer a question like what's going on in my system are answers to the questions I had in mind 6 months ago when I tried to figure out what information I would need to figure out whether my system was healthy or not. In contrast, an observability tool should let you say, oh, well, is my system healthy? What does healthy mean today? What do I care about today? If I see some sort of anomaly in a graph or I see some kind of something odd, I should be able to continue investigating that thread without losing track of where I am or again relying on answers for past questions.
So does that mean that curating these dashboards to begin with is just the wrong way to go? Like, is it just a bad idea?
I think dashboards can be useful, but I think that overuse of them has led to a lot of really bad habits in our industry.
Yeah, tell me more about the bad habits there.
an analogy I like to use is when you go to the doctor and you're not feeling well, a doctor looks at you and asks you, what doesn't feel well? Oh, it's your head. what kind of pain are you feeling in your head? Heart, like acute? Is it just kind of a dull ache? Oh, it's acute. Where in your head? They're asking progressively more detailed questions based on what they've learned at each step along the way. Honestly, this kind of parallels a kind of the natural human problem-solving mindset. In contrast, I think the bad habits that dashboards lead us to build are things like, it would be the equivalent of a doctor saying, oh, well, based on the charts from the last three times you visited, you broke your ankle and you skinned your knee. Let's pretend you go to the doctor to skin your knee. You broke your ankle last time. Did you break your ankle again? No? Oh, okay. How's your knee doing? It's with dashboards, we have built up this belief that these answers to past questions that we've asked are going to continue to be relevant today.
Yeah.
And there's no guarantee that they are, especially for, you know, our engineering teams are staying on top of incidents and responding and fixing things that they've found along the way. You're going to continue to run into new problems, new kind of strange interactions between components, and you're going to need to be able to ask new questions of what your systems are doing today.
It seems like with that dashboard problem, we have that same issue with alerting. I've started calling this kind of reflexive alerting strategy, where it's like, oh God, we just had this problem. Well, we better add a new alert so we catch it next time it happens. It's like, well, how many times is that new alert going to fire? Probably never. Like, you're probably never going to see that issue again. With dashboards is the same way. Like what you're describing, God, I've seen this 100 billion times where someone curates a dashboard and is like, okay, well, first thing now that we have this alert is let's go look at the dashboards and see what went wrong. I'm like, well, nope, graphs look fine. So no problem, but clearly the site's down.
Yeah, there's a term that we've been playing with dashboard blindness, where if it doesn't exist in a dashboard, it clearly doesn't, it hasn't happened, or you know, it just can't exist, because people start to feel like, okay, well, we have so many dashboards, one of them must be showing something wrong if there's something going wrong when going in our system, but you can't, like that's not always going to be the case. You to expect that means that you have this. Unholy ability to predict the future of your system. And man, if people could really predict the future, I would
right.
do a lot more things than just build dashboards with that.
Right. Rather than just completely shit on dashboards forever, what's a good use of a dashboard? Like, presumably you have dashboards in your office somewhere.
Yeah, I think dashboards are great jumping off points. And I actually, I very much feel like dashboards are they're just a tool. They've just been overused. So I absolutely don't want to shit on dashboards because they serve a purpose of providing kind of a unified entry point, right? What are our KPIs? What are the things that matter the most? Great. Let's agree on those. Let's go through the exercise of agreeing on those because, you know, as much as we like to think that this is a technology problem that can be solved with tools, a lot of the time these sorts of things require humans and process to determine. So let's decide on our KPIs and let's put them up on a wall. But expect and spread the understanding that that wall is only going to tell us when to start paying attention. Dashboards themselves can't be our way of debugging or our way of interacting with our systems.
Right. So in other words, that dashboard is going to tell you that something has gone wrong, but it won't tell you what.
Right.
I think that's a fantastic thing. And that actually mirrors a lot of the current advice around alerting strategy too. Of you find your SLIs, alert only on an SLI, not on these low-level system metrics.
Yeah, I love watching this conversation evolve. I think Monodorama 2018, something like three talks in a row were all about alert fatigue. And it's so true that to see these people, to see these engineering teams fall into this purely reactive mode of, okay, well, if this happened, this is how we will prevent it from happening again. And each postmortem spins out more alerts and more dashboards. Inevitably, people are going to end up in a state of unsustainable, you know, hundreds or thousands of dashboards to come through. And then their problem isn't how do I find out what's going on? It's how do I figure out which dashboard to look at? Which again is looking at things from the wrong perspective. Dashboards tell you that something has happened. And you need a tool that's flexible enough to follow your human problem-solving brain patterns to figure out what's actually wrong.
Funny you mentioned the Monitorama. There was a talk, I want to say 2016 maybe. I think it was Twitter, where they had this problem of alert overload, just constant alerts. So they decided, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to delete them all. Just done. Like, we'll just start over. I'm like, that's such a fantastic idea. People think that I'm insane when I recommend it, but hey, Twitter did it, so I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, drastic times call for drastic measures. It's funny talking, being especially in the vendor seat, talking to a lot of different engineering teams about their tools and how they solve problems with their production systems. There is definitely an element of kind of the safety blanket feeling. Right. Okay, well, but we need all of our alerts. How will we know when anything is going wrong? Or we need all of our logs for all time at full resolution. And I get it. I think that there are patterns that folks kind of get into, and it's how they know how to solve their problems. And especially when things are on fire, it feels like you don't have time to step back and change your process when you're like, no, this is what I'm doing to keep most of the fires under control. But, and I think this is why communities like yours and Monitoramas, and it is so good that we have ways that we can share different techniques for addressing this, so that folks who are in the piles and piles of alerts hole can dig themselves out of it and start to find ways to address that. Yep.
Completely agreed. So I want to take a few steps back and talk about monitoring. There's been a lot of discussion of how observability is not monitoring. Monitoring is kind of, looking at things that we can predict. We think through, and feel free to correct me at any time here, we think through failure modes that could possibly happen and design dashboards, design alerts for those failure modes that we can predict. Whereas what you were describing earlier, observability is not that, is for the things we can't predict. Therefore, we have to make the data able to be explored. Is that about right?
That's about right. For anyone in the audience knee-jerking about that, I want to clarify, I really think of observability as a superset of monitoring, right? And the exercise of thinking through what might go wrong is still a necessary exercise. It's the equivalent of, you know, the software developers should still write tests. You should still be doing this due diligence of what might go wrong, what will be the signals for when it goes wrong, what information will I need in order to address it when something does go wrong. All of these are still important parts of any release process. But instead of framing it as, here's this signal, I'm going to preserve it as this one metric and immortalize this as the only way to know when something is going wrong, what we would say, what Honeycomb would encourage you to do is, take those signals, whatever metric or whatever, pieces of metadata that you would want in order to identify that something is going wrong. And instead of immortalizing them, flattening them as pre-aggregated metrics, instead, capture those as events, and maybe it doesn't make sense to define an alert or define a graph somewhere so that you can keep an eye on it. But instead of freezing the sort of question that you might ask, make sure you have the information available later if you want to ask a slightly different take on that question or have a little bit of flexibility down the road.
Mm-hmm. So thinking through all the times that I've instrumented code, hasn't this always been possible?
It has. I would say that...
I feel a very large butt.
I think that as engineers, we are taught to think about or understand the constraints of the essentially data store we're writing into when we write into it, right? We're taught to think about the type of data we're writing and the trade-offs, and traditionally the kind of two data stores, either a log store or a time series metric store that we've used, have limitations, either that limit the expressiveness of the metadata that we can send. I'm talking specifically about things like high cardinality data and time series metrics. We've just been conditioned that we can't send that sort of information over there. Logs are just going to be read by human eyeballs or grep, so I'm not going to challenge myself to structure them or put analytical information, potentially useful for analytical queries, into my logs. I think that the known trade-offs of the end result have impacted habits and instrumentation. When instead, like you say, all this should have been possible all along. People just haven't done it because the end tools haven't supported the sort of like very high-level, flexible, analytical queries that we can and should be asking today.
Yeah, you used a word there that I want to call attention to because it's kind of the crux of all of this, which is high cardinality. I have had the question come up many, many times of what in the world is it? and it's always couched in terms of like, I think of myself as quite a smart person, but what the shit is high cardinality? Like, it's one of those things of I'm afraid to ask the question because like I should know this. Like everyone thinks I should. I know it because I had to go figure out what in the world everyone was talking about. Yeah. So what is it? What are we talking about here?
I'm glad you asked. This is also why, for the record, our marketing folks have tried to shy away from us using this term publicly because lots of people don't know what it means and they're afraid to ask. So thank you for asking.
But it's so core to everything we're talking about.
It really is. So at a very clinical level, high cardinality describes a quality of the data in which there are many, many unique values. So, types of data that are high cardinality are things like IP addresses or social security numbers. Not that you would ever store those in your in any data.
And if you are, please don't.
Right. things that are lower cardinality are things like species or species of person issuing the request or things like AWS instance type. There's a lot of them, but there's far fewer of them than there are IP addresses. And
right, there's a known bound of that measured in maybe hundreds.
Yeah. And I think the reason that we're talking about this term more and it's coming up more is that we are moving towards a more high cardinality world in our infrastructure, in our systems. And when I say things like that, I'm like, well, 10, 15 years ago, it was much more common to have a monolithic application on 5 app servers, where when you needed to find out what was going wrong, you really only had 5 different places to look or 5 different places to start looking. Mm-hmm. Now, even at that kind of basic level, we have maybe instead of one monolith, we have 10 microservices spread across 50 containers and then 500 Kubernetes pods all shuffling in and out over the course of a day. And even just that basic, which process is struggling, is much harder to answer now because we have many more of these combinations of attributes, which then produce a high cardinality data problem. And I think that's why this is something that people are starting to experience more of in their own lives. That a lot of vendors or open source metrics projects are starting to recognize that they also have to deal with as an effect of the industry moving in this technical direction.
One of my favorite examples of this came from days back when I ran graphite clusters. The common advice was don't include request IDs or user IDs in a metric name. And to anyone running graphite, that's still a pretty common thing because if you do, well, it explodes your graphite server. Just the number of whisper files that get created is astronomical. So the end result is that we just don't do it. And like, you just don't record that data. But what you're saying is, no, you actually do need that data. Like not having that it's hampering your exploration and trying to answer the questions.
Absolutely. And I mean, in this case, request ID, user ID, again, there might be some folks in the audience being like, well, I'm Pinterest and I have the luxury of not having to worry about individual user IDs. And maybe, But I guarantee that there are some high cardinality attributes that you do care about that are important for debugging. For us at Parse, it was app ID, right? We were a platform, so we had like tens, hundreds, eventually millions of unique apps all sending us data. We needed to be able to distinguish, okay, well, this one app is doing something terrible. Let's blacklist them and go on with our day. And you know, if it's not user ID for some folks, it might be, maybe it's shopping cart ID or Mongo instance that it's talking to. Our infrastructure has gotten so much more complicated. There are so many more intersections of things. You know, in Graphite world, you would need to define so many individual metrics to figure out that a particular combination of SDK on a particular node type hitting a particular endpoint for this particular class of user, you'd have to track so many different combinations of metrics to find out that one intersection of those was misbehaving. But more and more, that's our reality. And more, our tools need to support this sort of very flexible combinations or more flexible combining of attributes in this way.
Right. Yeah. The more and more that we start to build customer-facing applications, especially like the applications where the customer can kind of have free rein over what they're doing, what they're sending, like, I don't know, a public API, means that one customer using one version of the API, using one particular SDK, could cause everyone to have a very bad day. And if you're aggregating all that, how are you going to find that it's them? All you see is just that the service is sucking.
100%. Yeah. The more, like, ultimately, we are all moving towards a world where we are multi-tenant platforms. If not user-facing platforms, then often, you know, shared services inside larger companies, your coworkers are your customers, and you still need to be able to distinguish between that one team using 70% of your resources versus, you know, other folks.
Right. Yep. So it seems to me that there's kind of a certain level of scale and engineering maturity required before you can really begin to leverage these techniques. Is that actually true?
I don't think that there's no, you must be this tall to ride bar on the observability journey, right? There are a number of steps. There are steps along the way that allow you to use more and more of these techniques. But when I think about teams that are, you know, farther along their journey than others, it's often more of a mindset than anything technical or anything like that, right? When I think of kind of steps along the observability maturity model, and we're Liz Fong Jones, our new developer advocate, formerly of Google, is actually working on something along these lines for release, I think sometime in June. We think of that, there are really, it's part tools, but it's also process and people. And it is, I think that there are some changes afoot in the industry about how people think about their systems, how people instrument, how people set up their systems in order to be observable, that really all go into, that all factor into how effectively they're able to pick up some of these techniques and start running. And, you know, choice of tooling is a catalyst for this. Ideally, you have a tool that, sorry, Graphite, lets you capture the high cardinality attributes that you want to, but that's only a piece. And I think that we are in for a lot of really fun kind of cultural conversations about what it means to have a data-driven culture, what it means to be grounded by what's actually happening in production when trying to figure out why the things that you're actually observing don't line up with what you expect.
So you've given a lot of talks lately and over the past year or two about observability-driven development, which sounds really cool. Can you tell us what it is?
Observability-driven development, or kind of, as I like to kind of zoom out and just talk about observability and the development process, is a way of trying to bring the conversation about observability away from pure ops land or pure SRE land and into a part of the room where developers and engineers hang out. So my background is much more of an engineer. My co-founder, Charity, comes much more from the ops side of the room. And we've really started to see observability as basically the bridge that allows and empowers software engineers to think more and think more about production and really own their services. And one of the things that I've pressed on in our in these talks about how observability can benefit the development process is what a positive feedback loop it is to be looking at production when even way before I'm at a point of shipping code. There are so many spots along the development process when you're figuring out what to build, or you know how to go about building it, what algorithm to choose, or you know, hey, I've written this, my test passed, but I'm not totally sure whether it works. There are so many spots where if developers gained this muscle of, hey, let me sanity check my theory with what's actually happening in production, people can ship such better code and be a lot more confident in the code that they're pushing out there in the first place. One of my favorite examples from one of our customers, Gecko Board. They're obviously a very data-driven culture. Their primary business is providing dashboards for BI metrics. They were telling me the other day about a project that their PMs were running, actually, and the PMs were the primary users here, not the engineers, where they ultimately had an NP-complete problem to try and solve. And their PMs were like, well, we could probably have the engineers like go off and try to come up with the perfect solution, or we could come up with like three possible approaches to this, solving this problem. We could run these experiments in production, capture the results in Honeycomb, and then actually look at what the data is saying about how these algorithms are performing. And the key here is that they were actually running it on their data, right? There's a realism that looking at real production data gets you that is so much better than sitting around debating theoreticals. And so they're able to say, okay, well, we've had these three implementations running in parallel and looking at the data, this one seems like the clear winner. Great, let's move forward with this example or with this implementation. And they can feel confident that it's going to continue behaving well, at least for the foreseeable future, whether traffic remains the same. Again, these are bad habits that people have fallen into, right? Where devs are like, oh, okay, well, monitoring something that I need to add right before I ship it, just so that ops folks will stay off my back when I tell them that everything is fine. Or that the ops folks have something to look at in order to come yell at me. I don't know. But it's like that shouldn't be the only time we're thinking about instrumentation. That shouldn't be the time I'm speaking for software developers here, should be thinking about what will happen in production. Because at every stage, more and more people are using feature flags to release their code. Cool. You should be capturing those feature flags in your instrumentation. And alongside, you know, hey, cool, what does X user think about this thing that we've feature flagged them into? You should be looking at, okay, well, what does the performance of your system look like for folks who have that feature flag turned on or turned off? You know, are your monitoring metrics, observability tools, whatever, flexible enough to capture that? Isn't that just as interesting as the qualitative? Does user X like this new feature? It's got to be. And there's so many things that more and more are starting to be part of the development process that observability tools should be tapping into and should be encouraging in order to break down this wall between developers and operators. Because ultimately, you know, like you said it, more and more we're building user-facing systems. At the end of the day, their goal has to be delivering a great experience for those users.
Right. Yeah. We're all on the same team here.
We're all on the same team.
So let's say that I'm a listener to the show, but I don't use Honeycomb. I can't use Honeycomb for whatever reason. But I really like all of these ideas. I want more of this for me. How can I get started with it? Like, are there ways I can implement this stuff with open source technologies?
There are probably some. First, you want to get a data store that is flexible enough to support these operations, right? So you should be looking for something that lets you capture all the bits of metadata that you know are important to your business for parse let's use this as an example, that was things like App ID, operating system version of the client operator. Sorry, for anyone who isn't familiar, Parse was a mobile backend as a service. So we had a bunch of SDKs that you could use to talk to our API. So for when we were evaluating the quote unquote health of that service, it was which app is sending this traffic, what SDKs are they using, which endpoints are they hitting. Those mattered to our business, and those are also, incidentally, much easier for developers to map to the code when talking about health or anomalies than traditional monitoring system metrics. So identify those useful pieces of metadata. Make sure your tool can support any kind of interesting slices along those pieces of metadata that you'll want. And make sure, honestly, lots of folks, there again might be some folks in the audience thinking, well, I can do this with my data tools. I don't know how many data scientists you have in your listenership. And it's true, lots of data science tools can do that. I know that for our intents and purposes, as an engineering team at Honeycomb, we care about real time. So that tends to be something that disqualifies a number of the data science tools. But I think that more than tool choice, folks who are excited about observability, folks who are looking for the next step beyond monitoring, should really start looking at places in their development process or release process where they're relying on intuition rather than data, right? Where else can we be validating our assumptions? Where else can we be checking what our expectations are versus what is actually happening out there in the wild? This culture and process is really what that observability-driven development concept is trying to get at. It's where can you be more regularly, efficiently, naturally be looking to production to inform development in order to deliver great experience for our customers.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. This has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Honeycomb blog is a great place to find kind of a mix of stories and more conceptual posts, honeycomb.io/blog. I know that we actually also have our own podcast. It's called the OlliCast. I think it's O11Y.fm.
Yep.
And of course, kind of Honeycomb Twitter feed, and we have community Slack as well for folks who just want to talk about observability and want to get a chance to play around.
Yeah, awesome. As a parting story, I was on one of the first trials of Honeycomb back when it was still closed, and I can't remember where I read it. It might have been like part of the in-app documentation. It might have been something that Charity said on Twitter, but like, don't use Honeycomb for WordPress. Like, that's not what we're built for. At the time, I had about 100 node WordPress cluster. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to use this for WordPress.
Awesome.
I did actually find interesting things out of it, which I found pretty hilarious.
Cool.
So there you go. I believe you actually do have a free trial as well now.
We do. We have a free trial. We also have a community edition. It's a little bit smaller, but should be enough for folks to get a feel for what Honeycomb can offer. A note about the WordPress disclaimer. I'm glad you got value out of it. I think that's awesome. 100 node, I will also say that 100 node WordPress cluster is a whole lot more complicated than we thought when we said that early on. And I think the distinction that we wanted to make there was, you know, if you have a simple system, maybe you don't need this much flexibility. Maybe whatever you have set up is working fine.
Yep.
Because ultimately, you know, over the course of this podcast, observability involves changes not just to your tooling, but how you work and how you think about your systems. And that was really kind of a disclaimer to make sure folks were interested in investing a little bit in all of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad you overcame and tried it out.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I'm a big fan.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
And to everyone listening, thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcast. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.